Let us fall into life. Kicking, screaming, laughing, loving, let us fall into life. Comforting the afflicted and afflicting the too comfortable, let us fall into life. Let us land upright in life and go forward to try and make love more likely, understanding less underrated, peace more possible, violence more rare. We have a favor to repay, for we have received as a gift of life everything. Our life, love, hope, compassion, our feeling for those who suffer, the feeling that wants to help, to reweave the torn tapestry of life, all these come with the gift of life which we have received. All this and more have we received. And life asks that we return the favor and give life, hope, love, and peace to others, to all others we can reach. Let us answer by saying, we are here, we hear you, we feel you coursing through our veins, we feel the love of life, we are the love of life. So let us fall into life, fully alive, for more than anything, our world needs people who have come alive. Amen. Well, I'm glad you had your howling warm up, because I want to talk about animal emotions today. Love, attachment, and grieving. Passions from the heart of life. This is an area where it's very easy to find religious stories, teachings, fables, or myths, or fairy tales, or children's stories talking about these things because they're our favorite stories. You think of a saying like, God is love, or love your neighbor as you love yourself, or Jesus is saying that the quality of your faith is judged by how you treat the least among you, whatever group that happens to be for you at any time of the day. But you almost never hear these sayings applied to animals, just other people. So it's not really a very big picture, even at that. And our history shows that the religious teachings haven't done much to improve our relations with other people. Just think of our wars, present and past. This isn't just human nature. Other cultures formed by other religions have a more natural inclusion of other animals as kin and an easier access to compassion as their dominant attitude. In Japan, for instance, there is a famous park called the Deer Park of Nara. It was set aside centuries ago as a sanctuary where you can experience the kinship of all living creatures. Deer walk alongside people in this park. And in a pond near the deer park, Japanese Buddhists buy and release small fish in an ancient ceremony of setting life free. This doesn't sound like an American culture, does it? Small children come to the edge of the pond carrying a bowl containing a tiny goldfish. Parents and grandparents stand by. This is a multi-generational family affair. Parents and grandparents stand by giving their blessings and encouragement as the children gently release this fish into the pond. In a flash of golden light, the fish vanish, and the children's faces are full of wonder, for they have given the gift of freedom as the fish swim along among their companions in the natural wonder of the pond. Very different culture. When I was in Thailand a few years ago, we visited a temple where Thai Buddhists bought or sold birds that people bought in order to free the birds. It's the same kind of teaching. Do animals really have feelings like ours? If that's the question, for goodness sake, don't ask a scientist. Ask a pet owner. Ask someone who's been loved by a dog and loved it back. Animals love, form attachments. They grieve at the loss of the one they love. Sometimes they die of grief. They can recognize and respond to the distress and loss of others and seek to comfort them. It's the most natural thing in the world. And they welcome reciprocal comfort. Now, this is the golden rule in action, tens of millions of years before humans even evolved. In the last few years, we've learned that there may be more communication between the human fetus and the mother than was previously thought possible. We know that the fetus hears sounds in the womb, and this makes us like many other animals. Even in chickens, information is communicated by embryos inside the egg to the incubating hen. Even before birth, the chick is able to make sounds both of distress and pleasure to which the mother hen reacts. A day or so before hatching, the chick will often utter distress peeps. The mother hen then moves her body on the egg, shifts her weight, or makes a reassuring call to the embryo, which is followed by a pleasure call on the part of the chicken still inside the egg. In other words, the bond between the chicks and their mother hen start before birth. So it makes sense that a chick responds immediately after birth only to the calls of his mother. He recognizes her voice. A mother duck is usually silent while sitting on eggs, but as soon as her unhatched chick inside the eggs begins to peep, she too makes a quiet squeaking noise. Ducklings and mother ducks respond to each other's calls before the eggs hatch. There's a connection. And what about the odd fact that a dog only wags his tail at something alive? You can give a dog food from a machine, and the dog will be grateful for the food and eat it, but he never wags his tail at the machine. But the dog will wag her tail at people, even people who don't give her food. Dogs only wag their tail at things that are alive. People who train dogs to do rescue work, such as finding people buried under an avalanche or under rubble when a building collapses, say that the dogs need to find a certain number of people alive, or they become so disappointed that they refuse to work any longer. After the bombing in Oklahoma City, a rescue worker found that her rescue dogs were becoming depressed at having no success, and so she decided to plant a live person in the rubble and brought her dogs by one at a time to let them find the live person. This cheered the dogs up considerably, and they were happy to go back to work. In other words, the dogs weren't just doing this work for treats. They wanted and needed to feel that they were saving real live people. There's a life connection. And what about love? Do animals love? Could they have anything to teach us about love, commitment, attachment, even romance? It's hard to talk about whether other animals love, since they don't tell us, unless we look at their behavior and what that behavior would mean if we did it. And there are thousands of stories about attachment and commitment in other animals. Take the matter, some of these are kind of interesting and surprising. Take the matter of long-term loving relationships where we pride ourselves on being expert. Never mind why. More than 90% of bird species are monogamous. And in many of them, the pairs mate for life. Fewer mammals are monogamous, and the non-human primates appear comparatively callous when it comes to commitment. Chimpanzee males, for example, don't spend much time courting, mating, or remaining with a female whose young they've fathered. And if divorce statistics in our society are any indication, we ourselves are hardly role models for committed love. So if we can learn anything from anyone, it's worth looking around. And some animals are good at keeping even romance alive. This is one of the more interesting stories of the week. In some monogamous species, in which the same male and female breed from year to year, courtship is prolonged and the vows need to be renewed every year. In coyotes and wolves, for example, males and females who mated previously may act like strangers the following season, and a new round of courtship and companionship is in order before they pair off again, rejecting all other suitors. Once their young are born, they stay together, forming a true family unit until the next breeding time. Here there seems to be an awareness of attraction mixed with a spark that keeps it alive by insisting on fresh courtship every year. This sounds pretty advanced. It's also hard to imagine anything more tender than the nurturing that animals lavish on their babies, all animals, human and other. To begin to grasp the depth of parental love, you only need to watch a mother gorilla ceaselessly grooming and cuddling her infant, or in some photos some of you may have seen of the gorilla Coco, who had a pet cat that she named All Ball in sign language, a picture of Coco cuddling this kitten. Or watch a cat bathing her newborn kittens, or whales tirelessly escorting their calves and protecting them from predators. Animal mothers, and in some species fathers, older siblings, aunts, uncles, and even cousins will feed youngsters, will retrieve them if they stray, and will patiently teach them the skills they need to survive. There are chimpanzee troops, I think I talked about last time, where the chimpanzees are taught how to use a hammer and anvil, two different rocks, to break open very hard nuts. They teach this generation after generation after generation. There are others where the chimps and monkeys are taught to bang rocks together to do other things. Killer whales routinely will teach their young how to hunt. They have scenes of orcas teaching a young how to sweep a polar bear off an ice floe. An older whale beaching itself on an ice floe intentionally to try to teach the young orca how to do this. Without culture, animals couldn't survive much more than we could. They learned these things. There have also been stories about animal emotions in the newspapers, in the popular press. In one story, a troop of about 100 rhesus monkeys in India brought all traffic to a halt after a baby monkey was hit by a car. The monkeys encircled the injured infant, whose hind legs were crushed and who lay in the road unable to move, and the monkeys blocked all traffic. A government official reported that the monkeys were angry. How do you say understatement? And a local shopkeeper was quoted as saying it was very emotional. Some of them massaged its legs. Finally, they left the scene carrying the injured baby with them. In another incident, baboons in Saudi Arabia waited for 3 days on the side of the road to take revenge on a driver who had killed a member of their troop. They recognized and remembered the car and the driver. The baboons lay in waiting and ambushed the driver. After one baboon screamed when the driver passed by them, the angry baboons threw stones at the car and broke its windshield. Did the monkeys love their baby? Did the baboons have a sense of outrage, justice, or vengeance against the human who killed one of theirs? Is the Pope Catholic? And if monkeys, baboons, and others show behaviors that we would call loving, what about the love that extends not only to their kind, but even to other species? That's going well beyond the golden rule. Here's a story about Joanne and Lulu. Joanne was a human. Lulu was her 200-pound pet Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. Joanne was in her kitchen one afternoon, feeling unwell, when Lulu suddenly charged out of a doggy door made for a 20-pound dog, scraping her sides raw to the point of drawing blood to get through it. She ran into the street, and Lulu proceeded to draw attention by lying down in the middle of the road until a car stopped. Then she led the driver to her owner's house, where Joanne had suffered a heart attack. Lulu felt this before it came. Joanne was rushed to the hospital, and the ASPCA awarded Lulu a gold medal for her heroism. Joanne knows in her bones that Lulu's sixth sense saved her life. But was it really heroism? Isn't it simpler to call it love? That's what we'd call it if Lulu were a human. What did it require for Lulu to do what she did for Joanne? Think of all the steps. Obviously, there was a commitment to her friend. There was some awareness of how to bring help and that her friend needed help. There was the desire to bring help, even at pain to herself. And there was the ability to figure out how to bring help in a way she'd never had to bring help before. Yet we're unwilling to credit the pig with a thought like, oh dear, Joanne is in serious trouble. At whatever cost to my own well-being, I must bring her the kind of help that can save her life. No, I don't think the pig said that either. But her behavior showed that those sensitivities, concerns, motives, and abilities existed in her as they have existed in animals for tens of millions of years before humans ever came along. And what if Lulu hadn't been able to save Joanne? Do you think she would have grieved? Of course she would have. Animals have been grieving forever, as farmers and pet owners can tell you. Conrad Lorenz, the great Austrian naturalist who spent his whole life living with and studying animals, once wrote that you really can't do a good job of studying an animal unless you love it. He was famous for his experiments on imprinting, got a whole bunch of baby gray lag geese to imprint on him and follow him around, thinking he was their mother. After years of studying these geese, he wrote that a gray lag goose that has lost its partner shows all the symptoms that John Bowlby has described in young human children in his famous book on infant grief. The eyes sink deep into their sockets, and the individual has an overall drooping experience, literally letting the head hang. There are lots of stories about animals grieving, and we seem to recognize what they're feeling instantly. For example, here's an interesting paragraph by Alexander Scutch, who at 97 years of age was still conducting field research on birds in Costa Rica. In his book, The Minds of Birds, he wrote this, I think, very intriguing paragraph. It's remarkable how often the sounds that birds make suggest the emotions that we might feel in similar circumstances. Soft notes like lullabies while calmly warming their eggs or nestlings. Mournful cries while helplessly watching an intruder at their nests. Harsh or grating sounds while threatening or attacking an enemy. Birds so frequently respond to events in tones such as we might use that we suspect their emotions may be similar to our own. It's certainly how it sounds to those who work with birds. In the Rocky Mountains, a biologist was observing the nest of two peregrine falcons, which she had named Arthur and Jenny. I don't know what the falcons called one another. And she watched them as both parents, Arthur and Jenny, busily fed their five nestlings. One morning, only the male falcon visited the nest. Jenny didn't appear at all. And Arthur's behavior changed markedly. When he arrived with food, he waited by the nest for as much as an hour before flying off to hunt again, something he'd never done before. He called out again and again and listened for his mate's answer. Jenny didn't appear the next day or the next. Late on the third day, perched by the nest, Arthur uttered an unfamiliar sound, the biologist said. A cry like the screeching moan of a wounded animal, the cry of a creature in suffering. The shocked biologist wrote, "The sadness in the outcry was unmistakable. Having heard it, I will never doubt that an animal can suffer emotions that we humans like to think belong to our species alone." But it's not just birds and wolves, it's everything. A woman named Cynthia Moss has been studying elephants in Africa for over 35 years. She wrote a book that's pretty boring to read because there's so many details. But that's what makes her stories reliable. They're just details. And she wrote about a story that's been quoted over and over and over again. When an elephant family was attacked and a poacher's bullet entered the lungs of a young female elephant, Tina. After the herd had escaped from danger, Tina's knees started to buckle, and the others leaned into her to keep her upright, but Tina slipped beneath them anyway and died with a shudder. Now, Teresa and Trista, her mother and sister, became frantic and knelt down and tried to lift her up. They worked their tusks under her back and under her head. At one point, they succeeded in lifting her into a sitting position, but her body flopped back down. Her family tried everything to rouse her, kicking and tusking her. One even went off and collected a trunk full of grass and tried to stuff it in her mouth. Afterward, when they'd accepted the fact that she was not going to get up again, that she was dead, the others sprinkled earth over the carcass and then went off into the surrounding bushes to break off branches, which they brought back to place over Tina's body. They spent hours doing this. By nightfall, the corpse was almost completely buried. When the herd moved on the next morning, Teresa, the mother, was the last one to leave. Facing the others with her back to her dead daughter, she reached behind herself and felt Tina's body with her hind foot several times before she very reluctantly moved off. So elephant mothers and whole communities grieve for the loss of a young one. And orphan elephants who saw their mothers being killed often wake up screaming. How could they be all that different? And perhaps the most important part of all this is that the love, the attachment, and the grieving are not restricted just to their own species. They seem to happen with whatever we have loved or been loved by. Some of these stories come from animals that bonded with animals of other species, like some of the chimpanzees that were raised by humans back in the 1970s, and what's easy to look back on as a strange idea for an experiment. But this is when they were teaching chimpanzees to speak American Sign Language, and many of them were raised with humans as though they were humans. Roger Fouts, the man who began teaching sign language to Washoe, the most famous of all these chimps. Washoe was born in 65. They started teaching her sign language in 66. She's still alive, so she's about 42, which is getting pretty old for a chimp. And Roger Fouts has spent his entire career with this chimp. She's now with him and his wife and family at University in Central Washington State with the other chimps speaking sign language. So Fouts knows these chimps well and has communicated with them for four decades. He tells several stories of watching young chimpanzees raised by humans dying of grief or terminal kind of separation anxiety. He told three or four, I picked just one. One is about a chimp named Salome. Salome began learning sign language at 4 months, about the same age when deaf children begin signing. Thanks to her precociousness, she appeared in a 1972 Life magazine spread, along with Lucy and some of the other famous chimps of the time. Salome was raised by a married human couple. Just when Salome was out of infancy, the human wife became pregnant. After their baby was born, the couple decided to take a vacation with their new child, and immediately Salome lapsed into pneumonia and was close to death. Her adoptive human parents were notified. They rushed home, and Salome recovered from her grief-induced illness. Shortly thereafter, they decided to try another vacation, but this time Salome didn't make it. She died within a few days. That quick. Since animals can't speak English, some people think we can't ever really know whether they feel as we do. But some of the apes who learned to communicate through sign language or keyboards can communicate directly with us in a shared language. So we can know. Roger tells a story, one of my favorites, about Washoe. Fouts required all the volunteers who work with the chimps to learn sign language. This is a place where the chimps make the rules and the humans serve them. So everyone has to be able to communicate in American Sign Language with the chimps. And he told the story of one of them, a woman named Kat, who had worked with Washoe. Kat was pregnant, and Washoe was very interested in the woman's belly, and every time she came, Washoe would sign to ask her about the baby and how was her baby. Unfortunately, Kat had a miscarriage. And afterwards, she didn't come back to the lab for several days. When she finally did come back, Washoe greeted her warmly, but then moved away and let Kat know that she was upset that she'd been gone. Knowing that Washoe had lost two of her own children, Kat decided to tell her the truth. "My baby died," Kat signed to her. Washoe looked down to the ground. Then she looked into Kat's eyes and she signed, "Cry," touching her finger to her own eye and bringing it down her cheek. That single word, "cry," Kat said later, told her more about Washoe than all of her longer, more grammatically perfect sentences. When Kat had to leave that day, Washoe didn't want her to go, and she signed, "Please, person, hug." Reading these animal stories, and others like them, has convinced me that one of the worst stories ever told about the human condition is that Christian story about all of us being born in a state of original sin. Sinners to the core, needing the intervention of a church or its priests, I think it's an evil story, and it's wrong all the way down. We seem to be born embedded in a world of living and feeling beings who can feel joy and sorrow, who can love and lose, who can reach out to others, sometimes with just a single gesture, like the sign for cry, that offers us a reconnection with the force of life itself. But we've taught ourselves bad stories. We've taught ourselves unfeeling stories that can glorify selfishness and greed or invasion and occupation of another country. Today, when the cries and screams of agony and grieving arise in the world, they most often arise because of our armies, our economic policies, and our official heartlessness. Those little goldfish, the children set free in Japan's Deer Park, the small birds that Thai Buddhists set free as acts of liberation and piety. That's the message from life. And it tells us that we too can set life free within us and around us. We can set life free. Let's do it.